Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I am doing well today. Yeah, I've got my coffee. I've been up for probably like a good half hour so far.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry for getting you up so early.
Oh, this is not early at all. I'm just having a nice, relaxed day today. So.
Ah, okay. And you're not going to teach today, then?
Not until the afternoon.
Ah, okay.
Welcome to Breakfast Conversations, the podcast where we sit down one-to-one with amazing educators from around the world. I'm your host, Jacob Espen Hansen. And the man that I just woke up is Joe Chung from Vancouver in Canada. This will be a breakfast conversation in two parts. I have never had the opportunity to meet Joe in person, but it simply turned into a really lovely conversation. And most importantly, Joe shares a lot of insight and knowledge about some really, really important topics related to diversity, racism and anti-racism. Topics we shouldn't rush through. So I decided to let the important conversation flow and then break it down into two podcast episodes instead. Joe teaches at the university in Vancouver, where he teaches the next generation of teachers, and he is still active in the classroom. On Twitter, Joe is active under the handle @teachertong, T-O-N-G. Now let's jump into my conversation with Joe Tung.
I had my breakfast. I'm on my second cup of coffee, and yeah, it's a beautiful day here in Vancouver. It's nice and sunny, very very cold, but it's beautiful BC.
Yeah, and I also follow you on Instagram, and I see often a lot of beautiful photos on your Instagram. Mm. So I think it's a very very scenic landscape and. Can see that you're also enjoying the outdoor possibilities.
Yes, yeah. You know, there's like the concrete jungle that I think a lot of people know when they come to Vancouver, but really it's about everything kind of on the outside, like on the surrounding areas. So the area where we live is South Vancouver, and it just overlooks this beautiful Fraser River that really runs all up and down. You see. And then we also have a little cottage out in Hope, BC, which is just tucked away in the mountains, out almost in the middle of nowhere. But most people usually pass through Hope to get to some other big city destination in the interior of British Columbia. But we decided to settle there a little bit.
So that's a small place where you can hide in the weekends or...
Exactly.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, about an hour away or an hour and a half away and just beautiful place. Yeah.
That must really, really be, that's one of my dreams to have one day. So a very small cottage where we can hide or find some peace.
Yeah, we're very lucky.
And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. When I talk about it now, like a lot of the times I kind of go, wow, like that's pretty incredible. Like being able to say that we have that kind of escape, and it's a privilege that I know that not a lot of people have, and especially, you know, my parents being immigrants, they would have never been able to have that.
Right.
So very, very lucky now. Yeah.
So that's one of the places where those very scenic pictures maybe are getting taken.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Perfect. You said you are drinking coffee this morning. Do you have some special coffee preferences? How do you like your coffee?
Well, we just got into Nespresso in the last couple of years, which I'm sure is everywhere, and we're really just loving our espressos in general.
Mm.
Yeah, so we've been trying all the different all the different blends, all the different flavors, all the different things that Nespresso tells us that we need to drink, and we kind of go with it, and it's just that. Yeah, it's like a great jolt in the morning.
Yeah.
I can't go back to coffee ever again.
Yeah, I also really enjoy espressos and cappuccinos, and that's. Can you tell us a bit more about your where you are teaching, but also maybe take us on a tour when you are leaving your home in the morning and went to what would we see if we were going next to you?
Oh, well, it really depends. Yeah, I think on the day, but generally, if I'm leaving and going to the university, it's a lot more relaxed than I think my secondary teacher life used to be. Mm-hmm. And it still is too. I still teach in the secondary schools.
So you have two jobs now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I
more than full time busy.
Yeah. Yeah. So 80% of the time I work at the University of British Columbia, and then 20% of the time I work kind of on the side as a supply teacher or a teacher teaching on call at a school district just on the other side of the river from me here. So it's a really nice balance. I feel like I always stay grounded in the classroom versus, you know, just at the university and then kind of theorizing and not making sometimes those real life connections to what I'm talking about. So it's really awesome to be able to have kind of both. So I'm very lucky for that. Yeah. But yeah, if we're talking about me leaving the day, I think I would probably, the days that I go to the university, very, very relaxed. I am able to kind of do this right now, like with you, like, you know, have little meetings, have a cup of coffee, have a leisurely breakfast, and then slowly pack up the things that I need for the day and maybe even do a little bit outside in the garden and then walk in. So I'm very, I think when it comes to the mornings, I try to just give myself a lot of space because I have it, to not have to rush and get to places, that sort of thing, because it's a life that I think I really want to have, is just that kind of mindful pace that thing. And then I'll leave. I'll do my sometimes a few little errands here and there on my way to the university, and then get there and hang out for a little while. Sometimes go grab a cup of coffee and then meet some students here and there, and then go teach my class. Yeah.
And you teach teachers?
Yes.
So, young people that are studying and wanting to work in the classroom.
Yes. Yeah, so I teach pre-service teachers, or teacher candidates, we call them in British Columbia. And so it's people doing their usually additional 10 months to become certified teachers in British Columbia. So they usually have a bachelor's degree in something, whatever specialization it may be, or maybe a generalist area, especially if they're going into elementary or middle schools. I teach the home economics and the business education cohorts. So that's about like 30-ish adults.
But it's good if we still are connected to our inner child through the whole life.
Yes, exactly, right? Yeah, that might be a good thing to say that. Yeah, like we're all we're all still so curious into...
Yeah, hopefully.
And a lot of them are. Yeah.
I think that should be the idea, that sadly, the longer some kids go to school, the more of their curiosity they lose. Mm-hmm. You have to change that. Yeah.
So we've got about 30-ish students, and I teach mostly like methodology, so teaching strategies, you know, discussion strategies, looking at curriculum, looking at teacher inquiry is another course that I teach. So kind of looking at their own practice and how it evolved, and questions about what they do, and kind of that personal reflective, like self-awareness sort of piece as a teacher.
It must be super interesting, because then you get the skills to evolve through your teacher life and.
Mm. Yeah, and really, I think the mission of that course is to give validation to those types of thoughts, that it's okay to question your practices. It's okay to question things that are almost said to be status quo, and how do we move away from from some of the practices that we probably experienced as students, and started started to question the purpose of some pretty rigid practices that maybe don't actually serve the whole child now, right?
And it must also be very helpful for them when they I have met a lot of young teachers that say when they come from teacher training or their education, and then the first couple of years in school or in the classroom, at least in some places, they can meet a lot of older colleagues that have put a lot of value on certain traditions and so on. And it can sometimes be hard as a young new teacher to actually stand up and say, but I actually believe in that we could do it differently, and finding
That pressure is definitely there for a lot of them, especially because like as they come back, because they just finished their first little practicum with brand new school advisors and kind of getting to know school, like these new schools that they're in, a lot of them come back and say, okay, well, like, I think this is the structure that I'm going to work within. Like, is this what teaching is, like, forever? and all these types of questions that I think without perspective, it's really difficult to say, yes, this is best practice. This is what teaching for the future looks like. And also, what is next practice then, if we think this is the way that it's supposed to be and is going to be forever? So for a lot of them, there is that personal sort of, you know, I'm learning about all this cool research that says that it should be, you know, competency-based, that it should be self-paced, that it should be focusing on the learner, and all these kind of grand ideas, yet the experience is so different. And I think it, part of, part of I think becoming that student of teaching for the rest of your life, I think, is being able to not just question and analyze and evaluate the practices, but also realizing what self-advocacy looks like as a teacher. And so being able to say, hey, you know, I'm going to try this. And then, it may fail and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, at the very end of the day, it is for the best of the learner. And if it comes from the learner, and there's that, there is a sense of purpose and not just kind of doing whatever, right? Because there is the other side where it's just like, I'm going to try whatever. A clear purpose and saying, you know, these are the structures I'm putting in place. This is why. And then carrying out a plan. I think that's the kind of like action research oriented mindset that we want to have nowadays, right?
I think that's very valuable. And I think it's, as a new teacher, also when I look back on my first years, failing or trying this, there's so much in the first years of a teacher where we really have to figure out a lot of things. So I think that there is this built into it that we have to learn also by doing. We can't learn everything from the books. We also need to be in the classroom and try things out and be okay that sometimes we would have loved to achieve better than we do, but I think that's the only way that we can become more and more professional.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, because like when I look at the school, it's almost like its own subculture, right? So when a brand new teacher throws themselves into this new school, and a lot of our teachers, because of a big teacher shortage we have in British Columbia right now, they're getting jobs, full-time jobs, almost right away.
Yeah.
But they're being thrown into these cultures that they don't really know anything about, what the students are truly like, what the staff dynamic is, what the administration's like, what the district stands for. You know, how much money there is, what kind of concerns, you know, on a daily basis come about with union and admin and all this kind of stuff, that when they get into that situation, all that other stuff clouds the actual teaching. And so it's, I think, the preparation that my colleagues and I think are trying to really give them in this inquiry approach, because they see us with they see us three times, three different courses throughout the entire year with this inquiry mindset course. And we try to really just have those open conversations about what are you feeling, what are you experiencing, what are you observing, how do you evaluate what you're seeing. What words can you put to what is being experienced by staff, students, the whole school community, all of that. Because being able to express what's going on is so fundamental in being able to make sense of how to teach, how to you know, collaborate with that particular staff, with those particular students. It's such a big conversation. So I think when there is a pressure for new teachers just to get it right away when they start a brand new school and all that, and then having that pressure from whoever it is, not just, you know, experienced teachers, but everybody around them in the school community.
Yeah.
That's why we have teacher burnout within usually the first 5 years in BC.
Yeah, that's really sad. I think we see that in so many countries that a lot of teachers are going out of the profession already after a couple of years the first 5 years. That's I think that we could become much better at welcoming new teachers and also being aware that they need good colleagues that take care of them for the first many years.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you end up in education? What's your why or story behind ending up in education?
It's hard to say. Yeah, it's hard to say, like, one reason or one story. Like, I think for a lot of people, it's just that, and myself as well, it's just this like culminating feeling. And I very much embrace that teacher as calling sort of way of looking at why I entered, into the profession, because I toyed around with a lot of stuff or a lot of career options. And I think I landed on teaching probably when I started doing a lot of work with nonprofit youth. Nonprofit youth, that's not how I want to phrase that. when I started to work with a lot of nonprofit organizations that dealt with a lot of issues with youth. And so I worked with some organizations that worked to kind of combat food security or issues with family issues during different breaks and that sort of thing. So I worked with an organization that provided a safe space for students to go from, and they were mostly kindergarten to grade 7 students, to go during the winter breaks, summer breaks, during all the school breaks, professional days, all of that, so that they weren't going on the streets doing who knows what, and all that. And part of my job was to kind of look at the food side of things. So look at nutrition, work with some of the youth there to build healthy meals and serve the different people that were there, so that everybody had full tummies at least for 2 meals a day. And then they would come back the next day, and some of them had dinner, some of them didn't. And it was one of those really touching ones for me where I started to think about all of this kind of everyday sort of stuff that a lot of people were not able to experience or achieve or that, you know, fundamental right to have food. That was affecting students' ability to learn, ability to be who they were, feel like they had energy, all of that. So I went into family studies in university, and this was in my undergrad. Like, I was just sort of exploring a bunch of different options. It was like family studies, sociology, looking at family dynamics, food security issues, food sovereignty, all that sort of stuff. And then landed on home economics education. And that's where it just kind of went from there, I would say, into all these different realms, because then I just saw all the different ways that home economics connected with every single part of society and just students' holistic beings as people in the world.
Yeah.
Let alone learners, right? Like their actual function in society.
And I think, and so that, I was like,
Yeah.
That was also one of the reasons that I've been really looking forward for our conversation today, that, that you have a very holistic view on your students and in general, I think, that I really liked. Up to our conversation, I have, of course, also been a little bit of a stalker and tried to make a bit of research. And have enjoyed the couple of podcast episodes that you have made, and I really like also your 100-day project, or the 100 days of queer, where and you told also earlier that that your parents were immigrants, so in one of the podcast episodes that I heard, you also said that you really hate that question of where do you come from? So I don't want to ask that, but I often, when I hear that question, I often more think about where do people come from, in the sense of what do they have in their backpack, or what have they experienced along that journey that have made them to the interesting people they are today. So could I ask you to maybe unpack some of those things that you think are have been important for you to become the person you are today?
Well, I think, like even in the brief little synopsis that you just gave, I think you've touched on kind of a lot of the different things that I feel as if I wear on my shoulders all the time. And at the very end of the day, it is how I see the world, right? Like it is my lens that I look through based on my experiences, based on the things that I advocate for, based on a lot of the, I think, adversities that I've had to overcome. I think the conversation around, I think first and foremost, when I was a very young child, like the thing that I experienced all the time was the racism. Especially I think in the early 90s in Vancouver, where there really weren't that many Chinese people, as there are now. And there was this big influx of people from Hong Kong because there is a lot of things like that happening when Hong Kong was given back to China. And so there's a big influx of people that left, and my parents left before that. They left in 1979 and they came here, but that's when I started to see a lot of other Chinese kids in the schools, and people, for the lack of a better term, Canadian people, so Caucasian people around us who have claimed Canada, they were not very welcoming, and that was difficult to navigate as a young child, I think, and I think that's led to a lot of the kind of anti-racism work that I do, and also the just being able to stand up for people who don't have voices, sort of feeling that I have all the time. And so I think that's one of the things that always is probably the first lens that I look through, is how are people interacting in the world, especially around people of color, especially around how they use words like immigrant, how they use words like other, or what in conversation is perceived to be normal behavior versus abnormal behavior because it's not what people see as being Canadian. Like it's like all these little microaggressions that I seem to notice. And I think from there, and then kind of going through my adolescence and figuring out who I was when it came to, you know, my gender identity, when it came to my sexual orientation. I think that was that added layer on top of the, on top of the other stuff, right? Where, like, unfortunately, when I think back to this, like, there wasn't a lot of homophobia in this, in the student population, but where I noticed the most homophobia was in the teachers. And that was really hard too. I think as a young person, yeah, kind of trying to look for figures that you looked up to, but at the same time, you're like, wow, okay. So there were a couple, you know, saving graces, I think, when it came to teachers, but for the most part, there were some pretty like outward, you know, like aggressions, and that was difficult. I think that's something that I've had to deal with kind of into university, into even, yeah, like last few years, right? As we read about all the things that are happening around the world, you know, especially down south for us, down in the US, and everything that's happening there. But even like in our neck of the woods and seeing it from the teacher's perspective now of how there are hate groups that are in our schools that are trying to erase the fact that, you know, anybody that is different than a cisgendered heterosexual person are not valid. And that's, I think, very much harming our students in general, regardless of what gender identity, sexual orientation, all that, you know, gender expression, like who they are. It's really harming all, like, everyone. And so that's another sort of perspective that I have that's I think, yeah, like led me to a lot of the ways that I teach the teachers, kind of, yeah, like what does inclusion really mean, right? Versus what does diversity really mean?
I think it's so sad to hear that you have those experiences from your own teachers. I think one of the reasons that I really also looked forward to this topic, I think no matter where what your own background is as a teacher or your own orientation and so on, but we are there for our learners or the kids in the classroom. And I think it's so important that we as teachers have really value diversity, that we have that kids feel safe to come to us and tell us about some of those problems that they maybe don't want to tell their parents on, and that could be about gender, but it could be about so many other things, domestic violence or whatever. But I think that's so important that we as teachers are not just judgmental to our kids, because they so easily and they're so sensible for those signals if we are trying to judge them.
Well, yeah, and I think the fear is there for a lot of teachers of kind of how to address those issues, and unfortunately I think the way that a lot of teachers are addressing it is by ignoring it, or sometimes even worse, just kind of saying, you know, don't do that, but not having an explanation why. I think part of it is, you know, like just that general education and kind of, do I want to learn more about these issues nowadays? Do I have the vocabulary? I feel like I'm not equipped. Like there are a lot of those feelings that in conversation with teachers, I understand that they have. But I think when it comes to knowing our learners nowadays and having the language, like that is part of meeting our learners where they're at, is to be able to describe and know and have conversations with them about who they are, and in a very specific sense, right? Not just like, oh, you're this person's name and like that's it, right? Like there's so much more about like these people's feelings and you know what their identities are, if they're ready to share, all that kind of stuff, that I think sometimes we overlook, and we just kind of deal with the behaviors, and it's so much more than that, right? So I think at this point it's, you know, yes, like honoring diversity and making sure that as many voices are heard, but at the same time, it's that really important verb ally, and being able to put your neck on the line for the wellness of all students, and being able to sometimes take some criticism from other students, maybe parents, because you stuck up for a child and you stopped something from happening that would be harmful for them, or traumatic for them later on in life or at that moment, because those types of experiences kids remember, like, did someone stick up for me in this case or no, right?
Yeah. And I think every teacher will, has kids in every classroom and every class that need them to be a good ally and a trusted person that they can come to. It's so important that we don't ignore that role as well. I have worked mainly with young adults, but from age 16 and up, but I can see that if a person really doesn't feel well or are insecure, doesn't feel accepted among the group and so on, then it's really hard to learn anything if you don't feel safe. So I think that's also our role to make people feel safe if we want them to learn.
Because people in general will dwell on that, right? And kids especially, they'll get into just focusing on the interaction that just happened and kind of replaying it over and over and over again, just like we do as adults. Mm. And so if that's going on in their minds the entire time and we're pushing them to, okay, take out your math, take out your, you know, whatever it is, like, that they're not there, they're not present. Because they're thinking about their hurt feelings or they're thinking about all the other things. So that's, you know, like another big, I think another big weight that part of my lens, I think. And I think, like those two, but then I think the last one that I've really been focusing on in the last probably 5-6 years is because of the other two. Mm-hmm. So because of working with a lot of the social justice issues and, you know, like obviously there's curriculum work and assessment work and all that kind of other, you know, nitty gritty stuff that I do as well. But if I'm really thinking about like my why as a teacher, and I'm thinking about, you know, my anti-racist work, my queer terminology work, or my, in BC, we call it sexual orientation, gender identity curriculum. Okay. Like if we're looking at that, I think the third really important aspect and lens that I'm looking throughout everything that I do is the wellness sort of lens. Because a lot of the things that have happened with the other two pieces of my lens, I think I've, like, it's like it weighs down hard on people. It weighs down hard on me to be constantly looking through that, seeing things that are happening, you know, on Twitter or on Instagram, or experiencing them in the schools, at the university, and looking at, you know, and looking at prejudice, looking at bias, looking at discrimination, seeing it happen throughout everything in education. And it weighs hard, right? Like, and for me, it's that training myself to know that the hurt feelings that I have or the things that I perceive are not who I am. And I'm being aware of different things that are happening. Mm. But the way that I'm looking at whatever is happening in education is not, first of all, just because of me. and also the fact that I also need to take care of myself. And I think that's the thing that I've had to train myself to do in the last little while is turn off Twitter sometimes if I'm starting to see that it's starting to affect me in a certain way. And just realize the feeling of being so present when I am able to take care of myself, and that I'm a better professor, I'm a better teacher, I'm a better person, I'm a better husband, I'm a better brother, a better son when I turn off some things that aren't serving my wellness.
We all need to master the discipline of taking care of ourselves. This was the first part of my conversation with Joe Tung from Vancouver in Canada. Follow him on Twitter at @teachertung. I will also include it in the show notes. And in the second part of this conversation, we will go deeper into how we as educators can take care of ourselves And we will also continue our conversation about how we can create inclusive learning environments for all, also for the minorities that need it the most, which will be beneficial for all of us. In the second part of this breakfast conversation, Joe will also give some great advice to teachers that aren't a part of the LGBT community themselves, but who wants to be approachable allies for all their learners. Dear listener, thank you for finding the time to listen to this episode. Your work in education is really valuable, so valuable. If you like this episode, please share it with one or two colleagues or on your favorite social media channel. That helps me more than you can imagine. It really does. It helps me grow the audience, and that means that the voices of those amazing educators that I have those breakfast conversations with get heard by even more great educators from all around the globe. Right now we are around 300 regular listeners in our breakfast conversation community. But wouldn't it be great if we were 3,000? But most importantly, keep doing the amazing things in education so that we can give the next generation the best possible education and a brighter future. Until next time.